who the foundations of the earth. Tell me if you have understanding. Who set its measurements, since you know? Or who stretched the line on it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Or who enclosed the sea with doors, when bursting forth it went out from the womb? When I made a cloud its garment, and thick darkness its swaddling band, and I placed boundaries on it, and I set a bolt and doors. And I said, thus far you shall come, but no farther, and here shall your proud waves stop.
Next, we'll be looking at the subject of against all odds, looking at the life as it exists now, asking the question how he got here, and a new voice for Christmas. Anyway, from Job 38, which was just read, said, then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now, gird up your loins like a man, and I will ask you, and you instruct me. So this is kind of a question that God may ask all of us. You know, as we're here, how did we get here? For most now, the answer is evolution. It's not a new concept. We're just looking in their Will a Real Heretics Please Stand Up book. And actually, evolution was something that appeared back in Roman times. They believed men were nothing more than higher animals. They had the concept of atoms and everything else. And the fact that the world at that time believed everything except Christianity. They would accept any kind of theory except that there was an all-powerful, all-wise God who created it all. Carl Sagan, that noted astronomer and scientist, proclaimed that the odds of evolution occurring were 1 times 10 to the 200th. Probably very proud in that number. That is 1 chance in 10 multiplied by itself 200 times. You know, forget all the math work here. Note that the odds at 1 in 10 million, and we are only at 10 to the 6th. Probably the reason that so few statistic professionals believe in evolution is because that Borel's law, which we've looked at previously, states that anything beyond the odds of 1 chance in 10 to the 50th cannot occur. In other words, there is no chance at all. The law cuts off the possibility way before Sagan's theory of 10 to the 200. Statistically, evolution can't happen. In my college statistics book, in fact, two of the individuals involved in it give examples of how absurd, you know, the numbers are. The odds, they say, of like this, are the same as a tornado blowing through a junkyard and assembling a jumbo jet. Another one gave the example of a monkey sitting in a typewriter and randomly pecking at the keys and eventually coming out with the complete works of William Shakespeare. It gets astronomical. In fact, you run out of time before you have the possibility of even doing it. But it's not just the beginning odds one has to deal with. What about all the continuous miraculous odds of 1 in a gazillion that have to be repeated in order that for some following examples to be happening in life? I call it 1 chance in, you know, they only had 1 chance. If you blow it the first time, forget it. There are some wonders in nature that have to be gotten right the very first time, or the supposed mutation did not have a chance. First example is an electric eel can deliver enough electricity to stun a horse around 600 volts, more than you would get from sticking your finger in an electrical socket. The eel developed this ability for self-defense, yet how did it go about it without shocking and stunning itself through continuous trial and error mutations? Not only that, it can also recharge itself without an extension cord, and it lives in water, which is a conductor of electrical current. So how does it develop all this in a water environment, you know, without shocking itself? Also, the firefly, also called the lightning bug, has a special chemical called luciferin, which is stored in the abdomen. And when exposed to air, the air that it breathes, it gives off a bright flash of light. If you were given the task of finding a substance that burned without harming you when you contacted air, and a container to keep it inside of you, could you figure out something? Keep in mind, especially if you have no knowledge of chemistry or biology, but a little bug figured it out. Also, consider the firefly uses this method, the little flashes and stuff, for reproduction. It does its little flickering, each one's, you know, metered different. And in some species, this is also part of the mating ritual. So you can go to all this trouble of coming up with this, but if the lady doesn't like the way you Morse code her, you know, you're hung out to dry. No mating goes on. And she ends up liking some other guy's blinking light better. Most of us have heard of the bombardier beetle. It's developed, evolved, or created. As you look at it, you come to your own conclusion. But a defense mechanism that is literally an explosive device is what it uses. It has tiny glands that secrete two chemicals into a collecting vesicle, storage tank. The chemicals are hydrogen peroxide and hydroquinones. When attacked, it empties the chemicals into the vesicle and adds special enzymes to the mixture. The solution reaches the boiling point of water at 212 degrees Fahrenheit in seconds. The beetle then fires the boiling mixture into the face of its attacker. Now, how many times do you think it got in order to put all this mixture together without blowing itself up? A little closer to home is the human heart. While in the womb, a baby's heart allows the mother's blood to flow through it. So they actually share the same blood, same circulation. But at the moment of birth, two things happen just once in the lifetime of the person. The aortic arc coming out of the heart, the muscle in it flexes and closes down the aortic arc, shuts it off. Never functions again. That closes off the blood coming out of the heart. Then in the heart, you've got two little flaps that suddenly close down and make the heart into two chambers. And the baby starts circulating its own blood. Happens only once in the lifetime of the person. We all do it without even thinking about it, without exploring. It's the miracle of our birth. But if either one of those things failed, we die. If either one of them were to occur, the baby would pass on. Yet this incredibly complex procedure occurs in each of us without fail. If it had to evolve, there would be a sea of failed experiments. And be aware, each step in the ascent of man would have had to come up with this independently because there's no transitions between Neanderthal, Cro-Magnon, and all this whole chart that they often show. There's no transitional elements. So each one is a species itself, human species supposedly, and each one would have had to develop this thing in order to survive. There's also in life symbiotic relationships. They're not just singular mechanisms that had to develop, but also ones that relied on other species, depending on some other mutation and design of another creature. An example, some symbiotic mechanisms depend on other species for food. Animals eat other animals. Some animals eat vegetation or insects. Some vegetation, like the Venus flytrap, eats insects. So there's a cross of all sorts of species. How can any of them survive if they depend on another mutation in order to develop? Other mechanisms depend altogether different species for reproduction. The yucca plant in our own desert depends upon the yucca moth to pollinate it. Without the moth first going to the male plant, then carrying the pollen to the female plant, the yucca would soon cease to exist. The same sort of symbiotic reliance is also found among grapes and wasps. Grapes are not natural to California. They had to be imported, but when they planted them, they died. Until they found out that they also had to import the wasp that pollinates them. When grapes were first brought to the area, they would not produce. I just said that. Okay. And then C, the problem of couples. You think the amoeba had it all down pat. All they had to do was divide and be happy with that. But a gigantic obstacle is the mutation into genders of male and female. All the more complex creatures seem to have decided to split into two different products that also require each other in order to propagate or pass on their legacy. Note that the evolutionary chart consistently shows the ascent of man. Ladies, why aren't you in an uproar? What about the ascent of woman? Why did one not decide to remain, say, Neanderthal, while the other progressed on to Cro-Magnon? That is, there should be an ascendancy chart of male and female keeping track. As one mutated, the other had to mutate, or you'd start pulling away from each other. The Genesis record says little, but explains a lot. Such complicated designs for the lower animals and for man himself require an intelligent designer. Chance wouldn't do it. A designer who not only put it all together, but also provided some explanation. God said that he created man, male and female, in his own image, Genesis 1:26-28. This simple statement not only tells one how such complicated life forms came into being, but also answers the questions concerning where the abilities to reason, to love, to appreciate beauty, aesthetic qualities, etc., came from. Especially, even tells us the name of the very first humans. What evolutionary chart does that? God says he created man and woman, and their names were Adam and Eve. The Bible also answers the seemingly difficult question of where did Cain and Seth get their wives? The answer, from Eve, because her name means the mother of all living. Genesis 3:20. Very simple, little terse statements, but it explains everything we need to know about our origins. Conclusion. Most of nature is so intricately designed that it argues for a designer, as it should. Paul told the people of Iconium that it was the living God who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them, not leaving himself without witness in that he does good and gives rain and fruitful seasons. I mean, some things we take for granted, but a lot of times those seasons don't appear. Sometimes the harvest doesn't come. If you go to the museum in San Bernardino and look at some of the maps and explanations for the area, one of the things it points out that, you know, our four corners, not our four corners, but the four corners where the states come together, Utah, Colorado, Arizona, Nevada, whatever. The tree rings of the area show that at one time it did not rain for an entire generation, for 100 years. In fact, it says, imagine, you know, an Indian that never saw a cloudburst. You can't always depend on it. A lot of the weather patterns change. In fact, one of the reasons why it talks about what happened to Petra is that it used to be a flourishing desert, flourishing area, a lot of water and stuff, but all the weather patterns moved north. God just, you know, using that can bring out the destruction of a nation and force other nations. It forced the Visigoths and the Vandals and, you know, others out of the steppes of Russia into Europe. God changing things just by moving the weather around. The psalmist states that the heavens declare the glory of God, and the Lord grills Job on the man's ignorance of all that God has crafted. We still don't know. Look at the questions that God asked Job. You know, many of those questions man still can't answer. We need but look around us with open eyes and a curious mind at all the evidence to grasp the existence of the all-wise Creator. You know, you have to have an open heart and a curiosity and, you know, to look with intelligence. We are left without excuse, not only in the things around us, but we also have the divine revelation of His living Word, which we just read. He explains it to us. We've pointed out in the past that it's, if you've ever seen those giant radar antennas going across the desert in Socorro, or we had a couple of Goldstone out here, or the gigantic one that fills a valley in Arecibo. Listening to the stars, searching out to try to get some kind of intelligent communication from beyond Earth. Well, it's already come to us, and men are ignoring it. God is extraterrestrial. He is supernatural. And He has communicated with His creation. He's given us a library of books that took over 1,500 years to write. And He laid out the whole plan for us of why we're here and what we should be doing. It answers all we need to know about our salvation and cuts down the odds of missing the turn back to God and entering into an eternal abode. Okay. As we look at all that's around us, we're all looking at the same evidence. Creationists, evolutionists. So far, creationist pretty much tries to put all the evidence together. And most of it, you know, does interrelate, you know, in the belief that God created everything. It explains everything. The trouble with sometimes misinterpreting the facts is sometimes a dishonesty in the heart. With the evolutionist, they supply a lot of facts for their theory that are just not true. We've looked at this in the past, where most of the transitional skeletons are fake. They're frauds. They're known to be. But still, people still believe in it. One of the things that just came up, at least that I became aware of, is some of the facts that they don't present to everybody. Okay. Now, one of the things we've discussed in the past, you know, that expression, skeleton in the closet. Okay, that goes back to the discovery of the Neanderthal. And the guy that discovered it wouldn't let anybody, you know, really examine the skeleton, but it's presumed to be a messy length because it's all bent over and everything. But what was in the closet was the skeleton of a young person that he found right next to Neanderthal. And it was perfectly straight. 25 years later, when they finally got around to examining the skeleton of Neanderthal, they found out the reason he was bent over was because of arthritis. It really wasn't a missing link at all. Okay, facts that are withheld from us. But what I was going to say is something I just came across. In fact, I'll give credit to Dr. Harab. Some lady anthropologist who dug up some dinosaur bones in Hell's Creek, Montana. One of them was like a really big leg bone, and they couldn't get it in the helicopter. So for the first time, they actually broke the bone so that it would fit. And when they got it back to the lab, they started looking now inside. They never looked inside the bones before. And what they discovered was living tissue. Now, if that bone was millions of years old, there shouldn't be any living tissue, any soft tissue at all in there. In fact, when they gave it over to a man by the name Mark Arbitrage, who is a microscopist, I guess they call it, he looks at, you know, small particles of stuff. In fact, he's right out of Irvine. And he discovered inside of these bones, in fact, in the horn of a triceratops, DNA. Now, if Michael Crichton had known about this, you know, his novel wouldn't have been so convoluted. Because now, you know, they figure if we could get dinosaur DNA, we could clone it and make dinosaurs again. But how do you get dinosaur DNA for something that's died out millions of years ago? And so he went through, well, if we can find a mosquito that landed on a dinosaur and sucked some of its blood and then landed on a tree and the sap covered the mosquito, and they call that an encasement in amber, and then they can get that blood from the dinosaur out of the mosquito, they've got dinosaur DNA. Well, what they've discovered is that we still got dinosaur DNA. Now, here's the weird part. DNA has a half-life of 500 years. That means the original animal with this DNA couldn't be more than 1,000 years old. Dinosaurs did coexist with humans, and not too long ago. This is when Dr. Harb starts introducing all of his pottery from South America and all the different civilizations that show pictures, you know, of men riding dinosaurs and all that. The thing about this, though, is that this knowledge was known in 1966. And they've kept it down. In fact, Mark Armitage was a leading specialist in what he was doing at some university, and people had come to the university to learn from him, and when he published his findings of this DNA in here, he got fired. Now works independently at a lab in Irvine. What does it say for something that has to, you know, for a theory or ideology that has to lie about its position? One of the great things about the creationist, he doesn't have to lie. He doesn't have to manufacture facts or whatever. All he has to do is go by what God said and have a faith and confidence in that. In fact, then all the evidence bears out the creationist theory. And that's all we need. We don't have to be there at the very beginning when God created it all. Okay, the evolutionists can't do that either. But we believe that there's more evidence for intelligent designer. We just presented this morning. Things that couldn't evolve by themselves without blowing themselves up. You know, things that couldn't survive without a symbiotic relationship with another species. Things that couldn't survive without an opposite mate in order to carry on reproduction. All these things had to be a product of an intelligent designer and showing that the Earth doesn't have to be that old. To assume otherwise takes life beyond the odds. And according to the statistician, the odds are so phenomenal about life just evolving, we shouldn't be here because it's impossible. At this point, if you do believe that God is who he says he is, and then he is a fact of history, and you want to be a part of that. In fact, we might even say, if you look at the flow of history, it's right where God wants it to be. You can either get into the middle of that flow and have all the power of God working for you in this life as you go along with God in order to carry out his plans. Or you can find that your life stands in diametrical opposition to what God is trying to achieve. And that's a position in which you will not win a thing. What we're striving to do is carry on God's wishes, his invitation, to help you plant yourself in the middle of God's purpose and enjoy all the benefits from being a child of God here and in the future. If there's anything we can do to help you to purify yourselves of your sins and so you can stand before God, have the power of prayer in your life, have God himself, you know, rework you as an individual, beginning with having your baptizing, having your sins washed away, and having the blood of Christ continue to work in your life, in his word purifying you. Or if you've begun that and would like, you know, help along the way in the prayers of the saints, please let us know as we stand to sing.